This is the current federal tax developments for the week of March the 11th, 2019. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and your state society of CPAs. Well, this week we're going to be taking a look at a bunch of developments that took place during the week, including issues that have arisen with Section 199 Cap A in return preparation issues. So we'll talk some about that. We'll talk about guidance the Treasury issued about changes in how they're going to handle temporary regulations and sub-regulatory guidance. The IRS clarified that recipients of sexual harassment, sexual abuse settlements will not have to worry about not being able to deduct their legal expenses, at least if they're otherwise deductible. Gambling loss was triggered by impulse control problems or did not turn out to be a casualty loss, even though those impulse control problems were triggered by a prescribed drug. We have proposed regulations issued for FDII and GILTI. We also know the IRS is no longer going to plan to issue regulations to bar post-retirement lump sum distributions from defined benefit pension plans. And the IRS granted some relief on partnerships that have to add tax basis information to partners' K-1s. They'll be able to hold off providing the information till March 15th of 2020 for the returns they're filing now. Well, we're partway through tax season, and hopefully you're keeping up to speed with everything that's happening now. Lots of things going on. It's a messy tax season. Tax software is having issues. It's all the stuff we were kind of expecting for the upcoming tax season. One of the things I wanted to cover was I've seen a lot of discussion on online forums, listservs, online boards, Reddit, other places that have regarded issues on 199 Cap A. And I think we probably should take some time to step back and just kind of discuss and review some of what we know about Cap A and how it's applied to returns, because I've seen a lot of people who are jumping to conclusions that aren't really correct or trying to apply the rules and don't fully understand where they came from. They took a course, they read an article, they talked with somebody else. It's a little tough to know how we get all of these, but we end up with these ideas about how the rules work. Now, a couple of key cautions I think we have to be when dealing with Cap 199 Cap A this year. First thing is, as I noted on the Tax Talk group for Cal CPA, nobody in this area is going to be a long-term experienced expert in 199 Cap A. Nobody's been dealing with this more than a little over a year, because we haven't had it until then. Secondly, we have had like three different, I will consider, time frames where people wrote articles and guidance came out. We had a period of time prior to the issuance of the proposed regs in last August. We had the time when the proposed regs were issued last August until the final regs were issued in January. And then we have a much shorter period right here at the end where the final regulations have been issued and people have had time to digest things. Why do I point that out? Well, because people have been taking courses or reading articles or hearing about 199 Cap A ever since it was first passed. And positions that may have seemed to be reasonable, positions, what people are talking about how this worked back a year ago today, would probably not necessarily be the same position those people would have today. Why? Because now we have the final regulations and we had the proposed regulations. And that's difficult because the problem is, depending upon when various preparers have taken their courses or their updates or got into this, they may be looking at an article or a book or a, you know, CPE, shall we say, book, CP materials that were written in one of those three phases. I have materials out there that have been written in all three phases of the law. I have materials and taught courses that were before the proposed regulations were issued. I taught courses that were after the proposed regs were issued, but before the finals. And I have taught courses and issued materials that were written after the final regs came out. And the reality is that if you're still using that manual from back last May, that was before the proposed regs came out and before the final regs came out, then you know what? Things have changed. So you got to be careful here. So let's start talking about how this works. One key issue I see a lot of discussion of online is the rental safe harbor. And a lot of people have wondered, a lot of people, not necessarily online, but a lot of commentators have really wondered, is a rental safe harbor worth anything? By that, I mean, you have to meet such a high bar to clear it. 250 hours involved, either yourself or your agents, right? That rule, the record keeping, et cetera. Is it, you know, does it really mean, is that we have to do to have a trade or business as a rental? Well, two things to note about that. First thing is, it is just a safe harbor. The rental safe harbor tells us right off that if you're not allowed to use it, or you don't qualify, you don't meet the requirements, it doesn't mean you're not a trade or business. It means you go back to the case law. And we're going to talk about that case law here in just a second. But secondly, I've seen a lot of people assume it's a good if a rental is a trade or business. It's not necessarily, I think, in fact, I think for a lot of cases, it's going to be bad news if it's a trade or business. You might say, well, what do you mean? The 199 deduction, the Cap A deduction is there. How can it not be a good thing? It may not be a good thing if you have negative QBI coming out of it. Well, oh, no. We always make money. We sell the rental. We make a huge profit. We always make money at the end. We don't claim our losses until, you know, we sell the building, because that's how it works. And I said, yeah, but here's the problem. Those gains when you sell the building are 1231 gains. Under the regulations, if 1231 gains are taxes capital gains, they are not part of QBI. So when I sell that property with a $50,000 loss carryover for a $200,000 gain, the $50,000 loss carryover, if they are post-2017 losses, will be considered negative QBI. However, that gain, assuming I don't have 1231 recapture from prior years or 1231 loss this year, which, by the way, that loss probably causes problems with other things anyway. But if I don't have that, then that 1231 gain will not be part of QBI. I will reduce QBI this year, and either that loss is going to carry forward to reduce anytime I ever do get positive QBI in the future, or it's going to nail my QBI for this year. If, let's say, I have an operating business as an S corporation with an operating business that's throwing off QBI. So rentals being trades or businesses is not necessarily, quote, good news, unquote. And secondly, don't assume the IRS won't assert your rentals a trade or business, especially in a case like that. But let's talk about, if you fail, what does it mean? I've seen a lot of people believe that, oh, if we fail, either we can't claim to be a trade or business, we have no chance whatsoever, or number two, oh, that's great, we're not a trade or business, don't worry about that whole loss rule. Neither one of those is correct. Let's take a look at the case law. The case law goes back a number of years. Now, we don't know for sure. Let's be honest. Nobody can give you an absolute guarantee on any of this. We're in the area of professional judgment. But the case law going back 50 to 60 years has indicated that it's difficult to not have a trade or business unless it is a triple net lease. The key case going back to 1943, one of the earliest cases, is the Fackler case. In Fackler, the taxpayer was arguing he did not have a trade or business, okay? And it was the IRS arguing he had one. This was a gentleman who had a commercial office building. You know, he did very little with the building, especially toward the end. He hadn't even leased it right at the very end. He stopped leasing it, and then he went to sell it. He claimed he didn't have a trade or business. Why was he claiming that? Because he had a gain, and this is going back to the pre-39 tax code. I mean, we're going back way back in versions of the IRC. But that particular time, that gain would have been ordinary income, not capital gain. He wanted capital gains. He was saying it wasn't a trade or business. The IRS said it was. The Board of Tax Appeals, supported on appeal in 1943 by the Sixth Circuit, said it was a trade or business. You don't have to do a whole lot for a rental to be one. That was expanded out to cover residential rentals in the Hazard case from the tax court after the, you know, Board of Tax Appeals sunsetted, the tax court replaced it in 1946. The Hazard case held that worked for a residential rental. In the Hazard case, it was the taxpayer who was arguing that it was a trade or business because they had a loss. And the IRS was arguing that no, it wasn't. So that was a capital loss and you had to pick that up, you know, no more than at that point, $1,000 a year, not $3,000. The IRS lost that case. There is contrary authority kind of in the Second Circuit, the Greer case we've discussed before. But even then, Greer seems like if you do a bit more, you know, if you're at least doing a bit more, maybe it's not quite as simple as it is everywhere else, but even there, it doesn't appear to be impossible to be in a trader business with your rental. Now, what's a trader business? The Supreme Court in 1987 in the Grossinger case came down and told us it's facts and circumstances. There's going to be regular and significant involvement, tells us we've got a trader business if we're doing something for a profit. And they're going to say, and it's a vague test. The Supreme Court said, yeah, it's a vague test. We're not going to come up with any sort of bright line test. We believe that would be counterproductive. We believe it would also upset the entire code because Congress has used this term so many places that we don't think some sort of crazy bright line test that's tied in with the question, you know, that's tied in so that we could specifically deal with Grossinger dealt with a gambler, you know, that would deal with this case could conceivably have implications that would cause problems elsewhere. So we think it's a general purpose, broad rule. We don't think we should be drawing bright line structures that could have consequences that we haven't totally thought out. So Grossinger holds for that, which basically endorsed the law that we saw, Fackler, Hazard, and cases in other areas where we've had trader business. So the catch is you've got to decide on your own, do I have a trader business? If I don't have a self-rental, which we know is a trader business, and I don't have a safe harbor for which I'm going to make the election, then gang, you got to decide, you know, do I or don't I? And it's professional judgment. And you and your client need to discuss the pros and cons, the strength of a position or lack of strength of a position, and then decide what you're going to do on the returns. That's where we stand. The other thing I've run into a number of times is people who get really, really confused about whether the equity holder has to do something to get a 199 cap A deduction. What do I mean by that? We have a partnership, five partners. One of the partners is down there. He runs the candy store. He does all the work. He takes care of the bookkeeping. He does the management. He's there hiring people. He's there actually behind the cash register. And the other four partners merely put up the money to get him in there. They don't do anything except sit back, wait for their K-1s every year, you know, and if there's a capital call, they'll put some money in. But otherwise, that's all their other involvement. Now, I've seen multiple times case like that posted where the guy says, well, you know, obviously my, you know, the guy who's in there working every day gets 199 cap A deduction. But of course, the other four don't, right? No, that's not how it works. Ignore totally what an equity holder does. We don't care what they do. That's not a relevant point, at least not directly relevant. What is relevant is what does somebody, whether an equity holder or not, who is either an owner or an agent of the owners, do in terms of this undertaking? And is there enough regular and continuous activity in that regard to have us consider a trader business? So in the case of our candy store, all five of them will qualify for 199 cap A deductions. And yes, that's true for the four that will also treat that income as passive income under 469. Do not mix up the 469 passive rules with the rules for whether or not you have a trader business for 199 cap A. The test for trader business is always made at the entity level. So if you have an S corporation, we take a look at what the S corporation does, what S corporation employees and agents do to see if the S corp has a trader business. You cannot rescue that activity at the owner level, at the equity holder level. If it wasn't a trader business, the S corp level, you can't rescue it down at the bottom and make it one. And conversely, nothing the owner does is going to blow it, aside from like the anti-crack and pack rules, anti-abuse rules. But 99.999% of the time, nothing the owner does is going to have any relevance to whether or not that income is considered trader business income to the individual. In fact, even with anti-crack and pack rules, it's still trader business income. It's just not going to, it's just going to be an SSTB potentially. So that's not really a problem. I've also seen a lot of problems created when people are talking about or get mixed up with the aggregation rules. First thing we need to do is be very, very careful here about language. And why, you may think, well, this is crazy. Why are you going to pick on that? It's crazy. It's not an issue. Yes, it is in this case. Why? It's an issue for the same reason why if you're in a firm that you do A&A work and you do audited financial statements, go to the auditors and start just casually using the word opinion around them. Say, well, I think, you know, the company wants you, you know, our client wants you to write a letter to them saying that in your opinion, this is, and you're going to see an auditor freak out the minute that word is brought up. Because that word has a highly technical, very specialized meaning in the context of a financial statement. The same is true we ever use the word aggregation with regard to 199 Cap A. Aggregation has a very technical meaning. And why is that important? Because here's what happens. If we start talking about aggregating, you know, undertakings in order to meet the safe harbor, and I've seen people use that term multiple times talking about the safe harbor, we're going to aggregate the rentals to, you know, and then into an enterprise and then do it. Here's the problem. The minute you use that word, people start getting into the regulation 1.199A-4, and they start looking at these 4 of 7 tests, and they start mixing these things up. You should always avoid using the word aggregation in this regard unless you mean the technical term. And if you do not mean the technical term, don't even think about going to 4. Here's the catch. You do not aggregate under 1.199 Cap A-4 until you already have a trade or business. You cannot use the aggregation rules of 1.199 Cap A-4 to create a trade or business out of undertakings that are not already qualified as trade or businesses before even thinking about 199A Cap 4 regulations, or should say Cap A-4 regulations. The reason why, we can only aggregate trades or businesses. What you do at the enterprise level, you know, this is rental enterprises, is we combine these undertakings into their categories that create our enterprises, right? We can do those, we meet the requirements, we can combine them up to do that test. It's important to understand none of that matters about all these special rules under the aggregation rules about the four, you know, the four special categories, the four things you have to meet to aggregate, and then two of the other three tests you got to meet. None of that matters. Don't use the word aggregation. Secondly, aggregation cannot be considered until after you've already determined if something is a trade or business. Aggregation cannot make something into a trade or business. If you're using aggregation to try to create something and say, oh, now we got enough activity to be a trade or business, you're using it wrong. It cannot be used in that form. It only can aggregate existing trades or businesses. It cannot make something into a trade or business. Maybe you can combine undertakings, you know, to decide what is your TOB. That's fine, and that's a separate issue. But you don't even get to aggregation until you've already decided this is or isn't. And if you decided this undertaking is not a trade or business, you ignore it for aggregation. You can't use it for aggregation. That's key. The other thing we run into with lots of problems is use of the temporary regulations. We have the chance to use the temporary or the final regulations for 2018 returns, but we run into problems on it. Why? We got a lot of questions about KEO, SEP, self-employment tax deductions, and self-employed health insurance. And I've heard people say, oh, I'm going to use proposed regulations because under proposed regulations, none of those reduce business income. And that's not necessarily a true statement. What the proposed regulations say is they're silent on whether those reduce business income or not. They tell us that deductions related to a trade or business reduce QBI. But they don't tell us if those three things reduce or, you know, are related to the trader business. So that's different than saying they aren't. That's just not saying. And I think most people that have looked at the final regs would come to the conclusion that the IRS clarified in the final regs that these three are reductions. So the issue is, if you're going to do the proposed regs and not reduce your QBI by these three items, then you need to give me a reason why those items are not related to the trade or business. Because the proposed regs don't tell you they're not, they just don't tell you they are. And there's a world of difference between those two statements. I probably, based on some case law and the case law that tells us we can't reduce self-employment income for a self-employment tax by the KEO or SEP contribution, I can build an argument kind of that they're not related. But again, that's for self-employment tax, which is under a different provision than 199 Cap A. But you might be able to build off that. And maybe health insurance could have the same argument. That's a little weaker out there because nobody's really ruled on that one. And I really have trouble getting the self-employment tax deduction as how that's not related to the trader business. But nevertheless, if you're going to take that position, you need to justify why under the regs they don't meet the definition of something that is, you know, effectively related to the trader business. And yes, I think that case can be made for the KEO deduction, but I think it's also a case that comes nowhere near rising to the level of substantial authority. That means I would at least come to the conclusion, if you take that position, it's got to be disclosed in A275. It's also a position you better discuss with your client. You know, don't tell them this is an automatic slam dunk that we go this way. It's not. On exam, it may not hold up. We don't know how the service is going to approach that issue. They may go after these. They may not. We don't know. We can't give any real assurance in that area. So, you know, just be careful here. Where the proposed regs are on much more solid ground of going after them is, let's say you have a self-rental to a C-Corp. There, I think the proposed regs do include C-Corps because they just say you have a trader business. You know, they lease to a commonly controlled trader business that, you know, that basically that uses the property. That common control, well, we know the C-Corp has a trader business. Common control can exist between a C-Corp and an S-Corp or a C-Corp and a proprietorship, a C-Corp and a partnership. So yeah, that one is probably just fine. Same thing is true if we talk about healthcare professionals and whether they see patients. Under the proposed regulations, a healthcare professional had to see patients. And if they don't, they weren't an SSTB. So if you got a radiologist that merely reads x-rays but never actually sees a patient, then they're probably not an SSTB under the proposed regs. They definitely are an SSTB under the final regs. So again, if we want them not to be a specified service trader business, we may want to use proposed. But remember, if you use proposed, it's an all or nothing test. You cannot select maybe that one little nugget like healthcare professionals and take that nugget out from the proposed regs, but then try to use the final regs for everything else. If you use proposed regs, you got to go back and use proposed regs for everything. While there are some nice things in the proposed regs we might like better in the finals, there's some things in the final regs we like better than the proposed. And so you got to just check your trade-offs here. What, you know, what's going to happen depending on how we do it. For instance, there is a wholly different category of common control under the proposed regs and the final regs, and it's much tougher to have common control on the proposed regs. And why is that important? Because that could impact aggregation, and it can impact whether or not you have common control for self-rentals. So yeah, I get my healthcare professional issue here maybe, but that person's spouse, you know, we were able to do things with common control to preserve their 199 Cap A deduction by being able to borrow some UBIA or some W-2 wages from another thing they were involved in. Now we're going to lose that if we go protect the radiologist. You have to be careful in that regard, right? It's an all or nothing call. Okay, let's talk about cases here and things as we get here toward the end. IRS did issue a policy statement on regulatory process. This was issued on March 5th. They announced a change in handling, how they're going to handle temporary regulations and sub-regulatory guidance. They will include now a statement of good cause with temporary regulations. Previously, the IRS had said that didn't apply to taxes. A statement of good cause is issued normally by agencies when they do temporary regulations, which are kind of emergency regulations, rather than going through the full public disclosure, you know, public discussion, you know, showing them, giving them a list of proposed regs, allowing for comment, holding hearings. They don't do all that. They just issue temporary regs. Well, the IRS says that they are now going to have to develop a reason for good cause why they would do temporary regs rather than issue proposed regs and go through the comment period. We've seen them actually basically doing this during the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act period. We've not seen temporary regs issued in these areas. We've seen proposed regs on which taxpayers may rely until the final regs are issued. I suspect this is simply telling us what we already know. Also, they want to limit the use of sub-regulatory guidance. they are not going to assert, in essence, that there should be deference to these if they go to court. Now, some people suggest that simply doing what appears the Supreme Court's likely to come up with decisions here shortly that will limit that, and they're just getting ahead of the game. But they're not going to state that their position, anything that's not regulatory, should be granted deference at their level based on the fact that they're the expert. So that's kind of interesting that they're going to go that route. But it's, you know, as we say, we think the courts are going there anyway. They also provide that if they issue a notice that says we expect to issue regulations in the future, doing why, that those are going to have a limited shelf life and that you'll be able to rely on their statements until the regs are issued. And, you know, they're not going to leave these open more than 18 months. If they don't get around to issuing the proposed regs, issuing regs within that period, then they're going to pull off the notice. So again, there's going to be, what this probably means is less temporary regulations, fewer notices, and more focused notices. Whether that's good or bad, well, yeah, it kind of depends. We'll see how it works in practice. That's really where the question is going to come. The good news is we'll have comment periods. The bad news is, will that mean we don't get guidance quick enough to actually let us do things? We'll have to see how that works. The IRS issued on their website a frequently asked questions section for Section 162Q. This was a provision of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that barred a deduction for legal fees in a case that was for sexual abuse or sexual harassment and where there were a non-disclosure part of an agreement. The problem was, the way the law was written, a lot of people were concerned that this could bar a deduction to the recipient of the sexual harassment settlement. Now, I refer to this tongue-in-cheek as the Harvey Weinstein provision. And obviously, it was driven by a lot of the reports that came out the end of last year about, you know, major sexual harassment cases, about cases where, in fact, there had been multiple settlements issued by somebody over years, you know, companies over years for an executive, and they'd all been subject to non-disclosure agreements. So this was meant to shut that down. But the problem is, the way the section was written, it appeared to just say if there's such an agreement, legal fees are non-deductible. It didn't say only for the party that's paying the settlement. It said everybody. Well, now the IRS has agreed that, okay, we're not going to need a technical correction for this. They just stated that this does not bar a deduction to the party who receives the settlement if it's otherwise deductible. Now, it's probably otherwise deductible. For instance, you've got to take a look. You may find under Section 62, this may be considered a discrimination-based complaint, which may allow deductions under above the line. It could be part of a trade or business that is, let's say, a Schedule C. I could see something coming under that scenario where somebody was, you know, had some damages they received from customers who had discriminated or been involved in sexual abuse, sexual assault that related to the actual business. That's going to be a little more, that's going to be a little tougher to do. The employment one's a little bit easier. The discrimination side, the trade or business one's probably going to be a little bit, but still plausible, can happen. Be aware of that. The problem is going to be if you had one that for whatever reason was not a discrimination complaint or you couldn't show it was discrimination, that could be a little more fun to try to beat. If it, you know, because then we got the problem is miscellaneous deduction, which of course we don't get this year. But we're not going to lose it simply because 162Q says that we can't have any legal fees with a sexual harassment or sexual abuse settlement. And as they're saying, well, that was meant for the payers. In Mancini versus Commissioner, Task Court Memorandum Decision 2019-16 on March the 4th, we had here an interesting way a taxpayer tried to claim a deduction for casualty loss. Mr. Mancini was prescribed a drug for his Parkinson's disease, and it did a good job of controlling the symptoms there. But what he didn't know and what wasn't clear for a number of years was that this drug had a side effect in a significant number of patients, that it reduced their impulse control. So that impulse control disorder is referred to in the case as ICDs. His impulse control disorder was compulsive gambling. He lost nearly $3.5 million. Now, as we all know, gambling losses are limited to gambling income, so he has a big non-deductible loss. He, in fact, if you read the case, I mean, he wiped out his family, right? And he even wiped out his retirement. He's down to just $10,000 left in the retirement account when his wife and daughter stepped in, contacted the doctor and said, hey, doctor, we got a problem here. He's doing this. And, you know, we think it might be related to the drug. He apparently had been quizzed by the doctor because it became known that this sort of thing was, you know, a problem, impulse control. And he, as you might expect, lied to the doctor and said, oh, no, I don't have any problem with any impulse things. It's not a problem for me. I'm not having any issues, you know, and he denied he had any gambling problems. And yeah, he was gambling everything. Well, the tax court agreed that the drug caused it. But they said, here's the problem. We got a series of cases over the years that you cannot have a casualty loss unless there is physical damage to property. And the court said, unfortunately, you have no physical damage to property in this case. You just lost the money gambling. And therefore, it's not a casualty loss. Now, the IRS, though, did have an interesting discussion right at the end. You'll see it in the materials that we've got on the website. The IRS publication 547 that deals with casualty losses does say a loss on deposit in a bank, right, would be considered a casualty loss. Now, the court said, because the taxpayer cited this, and the court said, yeah, that's definitely not physical damage. They said the good news for the IRS is their publications aren't binding, but the court suggested that, you know, they were tempted to hold the IRS to this. And then they said, well, we decided against it. It is interesting. It's one of the first times I've seen them actually acknowledge publication and even, you know, vaguely suggest that, yeah, you know what? We probably would have held you to this, IRS, if you're arguing that this was a bank loss and non-deductible, even though we agree it's totally contrary to the law, as has been held in the cases. So that's interesting. I think there the problem is the tax court believes they've been embarrassed sometimes where they come out and make a decision, and then later it's discovered there was this IRS publication that said exactly the opposite that nobody had brought forward. So I think the IRS wants, I think let's say the tax court wants the IRS to be a little more careful in the publications. Not going to spend a lot of time on this because I'd not have time to go through 177 pages of regulations. It's tax season. But the IRS did issue, if you've been waiting for the FDII proposed regulations, that is the foreign derived intangible income rules under Section 250 and the GILTI, the global intangible low tax income rules, proposed regulations on those were issued. There are 177 pages of text you get to read through. They also gave you reporting rules for the new Form 8993, Section 250 deduction for foreign derived intangible income and global intangible low taxed income. Again, if you're involved with that, people have been ringing on those regs. I just thought I should mention this week, those regs are out. At least proposed regs are out. A couple of other notices. The IRS in those 2019-18 withdrew proposed regulations. They were in that they issued, not withdrew proposed regulations, withdrew a notice that said they would issue regulations that they wanted to stop defined benefit plans from offering temporary lump sum payment options to people already getting payments from the plan. The IRS argued if a plan was allowed to have such a provision in the plan, let's say after you've been retired for 10 years, you can take a lump sum, that it would require the annuities to be reduced to take into account that potential that there would be this temporary time frame where somebody could ask for a lump sum. Because of that, they thought they should bar that. Now, they never got around, though, to issuing those regs. Notice 2015-49 came out in the summer of 2015. You know, we're now sitting here in 2019, and we still don't have proposed regs. So they, you know, been missing for a while. They've now withdrawn the notice. They will continue to study the matter, but they will not, at this point, issue any, you know, where they were issuing termination letters that specifically kind of called out those items as they, you know, they're not making any statement about whether that's okay or not. They're going to stop calling them out. They're not going to challenge it until they actually get around to issuing the proposed regs. So again, this is in line with that Treasury proposal we had. Just really more of that. Finally, this week, good news for those of you with partnerships that report capital accounts on other than a tax basis. Notice 2019-20 issued on March the 7th. The IRS in the instructions of Form 1065 this year required that if you have a tax basis capital account that is negative for a partner, but your K-1s report on a basis other than tax basis, you have to file, you have to give basically additional information on the K-1 this year about that taxpayer's beginning and ending tax basis capital account if either the beginning or ending capital account is negative and you're not using tax basis on your partnership, you know, K-1s for their capital accounts. And you might not be using that because you're using GAAP. You're preparing GAAP financial statements for this. You report their GAAP basis capital. So now they're going to want you to give tax basis capital if it's negative. Well, a lot of partnerships complained that they wouldn't be able to provide that information timely, or at the very least, they would have to go on extension and not issue K-1s until, you know, September, because they had to assemble all this information about tax basis capital for each one of their partners, which they're going to have to build up. They weren't aware this was coming. It basically popped out in the instructions this year. And of course, a lot of people don't pay attention to instructions. So now they're just now realizing that issue's there, and voila, we have a problem. Well, under this notice, if you comply, you can issue your K-1s right now, file the return, not have the information on the 2018 K-1s. However, in order to avoid the penalty, and yes, it's a penalty for failing to provide information returns, the same penalty that applies to 1099s, so there'll be two penalties. With an inflation-adjusted number that's slightly above 250 right now per K-1, two separate penalties, one of which goes for not telling the partner this number, and the other one that will go for not telling the IRS this number. You will not owe that penalty on all your K-1s so long as you provide the information to the IRS in the form that's required under this notice by March 15 of 2020. So basically, you've got some time to do it, but they want you to do it. It's a little different than other cases in the past where the IRS has waived a requirement and they just forget it for that year. They're not forgetting this one. I think the IRS may be thinking here, to be totally honest, A, they want this information for exam purposes. B, they know in the past when they've just waived it, we'll get to this time next year, the partnerships will again complain they don't have the information, it'll take too long to get it, they won't be able to issue K-1s, and the IRS will be forced to again push it back. So what they're doing this year is saying, we're going to let you push, we're going to let you wait till next March to give us this year's stuff, but you better start getting information together for next year because we're not doing this next year. And we're going to get this year's information anyway. So, you know, don't think that whining to us is going to make this go away. We'll see how it goes. But in any event, at least you can finish those partnership K-1s. Well, as we say, it's that time of year, tax season. You're applying all the stuff you've learned during the year. Hopefully you've gotten benefit out of your education. That's key, I think, for all of us. We're involved here in trying to be dealing with our clients, dealing with tax issues, that we actually get something of value out of our continuing education. In times like this, where things are changing rapidly, it's really important to make sure that what you're getting is up to date. And for that reason, be assured, you know, you should be taking a look at what your state societies are providing in live continuing education in this regard. Because let's be honest, a self-study manual could have been written months ago. And yes, they're supposed to be updated, but we know that takes time. We also know that, you know, that document just kind of gets dated. And how updated it is and how things go, that's always kind of a question when you're dealing with CPE that may be coming from a source that just, you know, is, yeah, it's cheap, but yeah, we're not sure how great it is in that regard. You know, this is something that your state societies and the live sessions can provide you with up-to-date information from people that are keeping up. So be sure you're making use of it. And by the way, when you finish tax season, be sure to take a look at your state society catalog for the offerings this year. We hope you look at those that we're going to be offering here in Kaplan from Kaplan Financial Education, which will be through the Kaplan Accounting and Education programs. Those of you who are not aware, that's formerly Lascalzo and Nichols Patrick. Those are the ones that make up Kaplan's program. We hope to see you in the programs this year. This has been Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March the 11th. We're going to update you throughout the week on our website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, Ed Zollers at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. On Twitter, you can follow my handle there is @EdZollers. We post developments as they occur, plus they get involved in other discussions. Now, also follow discussions on the subreddit of TaxPros, /r/TaxPros, as well as California's Tax Talk site. That's on Yahoo Groups. Any CPA or attorney can sign up there. You just need to get permission to get in. So go to Yahoo Groups and search for Tax Talk. You'll get it. I also participate in the Connect groups for members of this Arizona, New Jersey, and Minnesota society. So if you remember one of those societies and you post there, I might answer questions there too. There's lots of interchange there that you can get from people who are, you know, also working on these problems. With that, an interesting week, and I realize I ran a little bit over again this week. We've had a lot of stuff going on here recently. Be sure to tune in next week. We'll try to talk about whatever happens coming from taxes. I'll also see if there's anything like this week where we see a lot of discussion going on in groups about issues, and we'll try to discuss anything that happens there. And hopefully we'll keep you going so that this tax season, hopefully we can stay sane and make it all the way to the end of this tax season. And we'll see you next week with Current Federal Tax Developments.